How will Wall Street welcome one of the faces of financial reform?
Tim Geithner tries to smooth things over at the banks.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, August 2nd. The Treasury Secretary goes back into the lion's den later today.
BP could be on the path to a permanent oil leak plug, but it may have troubles beyond that. And sit back, relax, and enjoy a YouTube video. There's 33% more time to watch dancing cats, smoking babies, the double rainbow. But first, in one of his first public appearances since financial reform passed, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is going back to the lion's den, and he's going to be touting the good the administration says the new reforms can do. Here's Marketplace's Elisa Roth.
The Treasury Department says the secretary will lay out the path forward for the financial reforms and talk about the core principles behind the new regulations. Cornelius Hurley directs the Morin Center for Banking and Financial Law at Boston University. He says it's not clear what those principles are, but he thinks Geithner will probably say something conciliatory, like this.
Look, it's been a long battle. We have a 2,319-page bill that we just passed, and let's all get behind it and make a good-faith effort at complying with these complex rules and so on.
But Hurley says he'd like to hear about one set of principles, those held by the people who work on Wall Street. He'd like to hear Geithner say it's time for a new ethic, one based on truth and fact.
And I would like to see that be his message. It's not time to rally the lawyers and have them make Swiss cheese out of all of these new laws and regs that are coming, but rather it's a new day and a new ethic that we should be talking about here.
It's a nice idea, but even before Congress passed the new rules, bankers were already looking for ways around them. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Manufacturing in this country grew in July, according to the Institute for Supply Management. That's the 12th straight month of growth. Another report said construction spending was only up slightly in the month of June, and pretty much all of the construction came from government. In another verbal snapshot of the economy, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said this morning the recession is abating, but we're still only a few steps away from going backward. Bernanke said the recession's led to less tax revenues for states, and the cuts that'll have to be made could spell a whole lot of trouble.
With the retirement of state employees that are part of the baby boom generation and continued rise in health care costs, states' retiree, pension, and health care obligations will become even more difficult to meet in coming years.
Bernanke made those dire predictions just moments ago at the Southern Legislative Conference in Charleston, South Carolina. Next time you pull into a gas station or buy a new suit, you may just keep those credit or debit cards in your pocket or purse. Bloomberg News reports Visa and MasterCard are in talks with the nation's two largest mobile phone companies, AT&T and Verizon, to get rid of plastic cards and make charging completely electronic. Rob Manning is author of Credit Card Nation. He's with us live from Rochester, New York. Good morning, Rob.
Ah, it's a pleasure to be joining you.
Kind of makes your book obsolete, doesn't it? no more credit cards.
The world is changing very quickly, but it doesn't mean there's not credit cards. It just means the way in which we're conducting our transactions.
That's right. No physical credit cards. But how long do you think it'll take before we're paying, you know, with our cell phones?
Well, I mean, partially depending on the recession, but clearly in 2 to 3 years, the marketplace is going to change radically.
Is this good or bad?
Well, you know, the real problem is for underbanked people or people with damaged credit, this could be a good option if they're don't have a traditional bank option. But the problem is, do we trust people getting involved in banking services that don't have that experience? And essentially what we're talking about is whether banks are going to be lending AT&T money or a line of credit and give you an overdraft protection. And that's where the devil is in the details.
When you say inexperienced, who's not experienced enough?
Well, what we're looking at here is tremendous competition in cell phones, and they're trying to find new financial services and new revenues. And in this fee-based economy model, this could be a way to nickel and dime and even dollar people to death with expensive overdraft-type loans.
So take us through the process as you're familiar with it. What would you do? You just pull out your cell phone while you're, you know, checking out of the store?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a variety of ways. You could have anything from visual connections with your computer. You could send it through a Bluetooth type technology. It's all going to depend on the functionality of your cell phone, which is going to change radically, which raises a whole set of questions. Will cell phones be lost leaders to enable them to conduct financial transactions?
Yeah.
And that's where the money is.
You're going to want to keep it charged, I'll tell you that much, cell phones. Rob Manning, author of the book Credit Card Nation. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
A couple of countries in the Middle East will ban wireless BlackBerry mobile phone use. Starting in October, the United Arab Emirates will stop people from sending emails, surfing the net, or sending texts from their handsets because of security concerns. And the move has prompted Saudi Arabia to take similar measures. The BBC's Katie Watson reports.
The government of the United Arab Emirates says BlackBerry is operating outside the law. That's because the wireless data sent from a BlackBerry, even in the UAE, is encrypted and sent to servers in other countries, including Canada. And that means the UAE can't monitor the information. Fevzi Turkalp is the editor of GadgetDetective.com. He says BlackBerry is known for its security.
The messages that are sent back into the inbox of BlackBerry users in UAE and Saudi Arabia are encrypted. The opportunity to snoop on them is vastly reduced.
The BlackBerry is one of the most popular smartphones in the two countries, with nearly 1 million users. An official from Saudi Telecom has admitted the decision is intended to put pressure on BlackBerry's owners to release users' data when needed, but the Canadian company has so far refused to comply. And critics suggest the UAE government doesn't just want to view the data, but wants to censor the information. In Dubai, I'm the BBC's Katie Watson for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, August 2nd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. One of the centerpieces of President Obama's health care reform package now faces even more obstacles. A federal judge this morning has let stand a lawsuit that was brought by the state of Virginia against a key provision of the health plan. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins us to talk about it. Good morning, Mitchell.
Good morning, Steve.
So what did the judge do here?
Well, he hasn't ruled on the underlying lawsuit against the Obama health plan. What he did do was to let the lawsuit by the state of Virginia proceed. And that means the Obama administration is going to have to defend it. This will be more in the news, not as a success story, but as a debate over government intruding into private life.
So what was Virginia's argument here?
Well, it's Virginia and 21 other states that have sued in various courts. They say the federal government can't force their state residents to buy health insurance or, in this case, penalize them through the tax code if they don't buy insurance. And that's a key provision of the health reform, that everyone has to have insurance. There are also now referendums in a number of states launched by the Tea Party and its allies that would nullify the insurance requirement in those states. Missouri votes on one tomorrow. Basically, they all take the same tack. They say the federal government, the federal constitution, doesn't allow Congress to make Americans buy something, whether that's a new toaster or new health insurance.
And what's the counterargument, Mitchell?
Well, the Obama administration and supporters of health reform say the government already requires people to purchase things. I mean, take as an example, car insurance.
Right.
And they say that the lawsuits are just obstructionist, ultimately predict that they won't succeed. They say the feds already have broad powers over health care. I mean, they regulate Medicare, Medicaid, all sorts of things. And that this is about cost containment. It has to cover the whole country if it's going to work. And if states start to opt out, the whole system falls apart.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with us live this morning. Mitchell, thank you.
You're welcome.
The big managed care provider, Humana, said this morning that its profits zoomed up in the last 3 months, up 21%. Here to talk more about this is Chief Investment Strategist Bill Stone at PNC Wealth Management, joining us from Philadelphia. Hey, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
So Humana and other insurers have the uncertainty of the health care overhaul law kind of hanging over them. Does Humana's jump in earnings seem to be because of the new law, in spite of it, neither?
you know, I think it's a little bit of both. They're seeing some significant revenue increases from some added memberships, particularly on their plans for seniors, this Medicare Advantage, also getting some premium increases there. Then on the other side, they've actually had some lesser payouts out of those particular plans. So it's a little bit of a combination of both.
Okay, well, lesser payouts. I have been hearing that Americans are getting fewer prescriptions, fewer elective surgeries because of the recession. We're cutting back. Is that showing up on insurers' bottom lines?
Yeah, I think exactly what you're saying is they are seeing some amount of less medical usage, which, again, does help their bottom line. They're also, aside from that, cutting a lot of their own internal costs. So a lot of that is perhaps getting themselves ready for this bill really taking effect. So, you know, trimming the fat here and there.
Yeah, we'll see how all that plays out. Thanks very much, Bill Stone from PNC Wealth Management.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, August 2nd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Until the 1980s, a funeral home was the only place you could buy a casket. The Federal Trade Commission has been trying to allow more competition, but consumer advocates say the agency has not done enough, and they have sued the three biggest casket companies. The case goes to a federal judge in Houston this week, and reporter April Demboski has the story.
To get around current FTC rules, the top three casket companies in the country allegedly wrote new internal distribution policies. They said they would sell caskets to anyone, but they would only deliver them to funeral homes. Consumer attorney Gordon Schnell says that allowed these companies to dominate close to 70% of the casket market.
The defendants, along with other funeral homes, have entered into a conspiracy to restrict competition from discount casket sellers so that they can keep their casket pricing artificially high.
Attorneys for the casket companies refused to comment on the record, but Mark Allen from the Casket and Funeral Supply Association of America insists there's plenty of competition in his industry.
I am contacted, you know, every week by a new upstart company that is trying to get some advice for getting started in this industry.
And that's getting harder these days as more people choose cremation. No burial, no need for a fancy casket. I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
Listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us right here in the United States. Engineers in the Gulf of Mexico say today could be very important toward the permanent plug of the leaky BP oil well a mile beneath the surface. Workers and scientists hope to begin pushing mud through some lines they created to begin to seal off that well. In the meantime, the British oil giant is lobbying hard against a plan to ban it from new offshore drilling in the United States. The House of Representatives has passed a bill to tighten safety standards for oil drilling. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us live from London this morning to discuss that proposal. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
What does this bill do?
Well, it doesn't name BP, but BP is pretty obviously the main target. Under one of the bill's provisions, a company would be banned from getting a license to drill offshore in the US if that company had been responsible for the deaths of more than 10 workers over the last 7 years. Well, 11 workers sadly lost their lives in the Deepwater Horizon disaster, so BP rather neatly fills that bill.
Yeah, singles them out precisely. How is BP, Stephen, pushing back against the bill?
They're not doing it publicly, but it's been reported that BP and the British government, in fact, are lobbying behind the scenes, saying that the bill is unconstitutional because it singles out one company for punitive action. Chris Grabowski of the Peak Oil consulting firm says the measure is also rather premature.
We haven't yet got a formal assessment of how the accident really developed, as to who was actually to blame. There's a bit of jumping the gun here and assuming that it was all BP or overwhelmingly BP.
Now, the Senate's bill doesn't include this measure, so there's a good chance the ban won't become law, but it does show BP is still facing a lot of challenges.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
President Obama says he wants negotiations on Russia's admission to the World Trade Organization finished fast. The call for speed has some U.S. manufacturers worried that Russia will be given an easy ride on all the counterfeiting going on over there. From Moscow, Peter Van Dyke reports.
Inside a shop barely bigger than a closet, the walls are stacked floor to ceiling with CDs, computer games and DVDs, including a dozen copies of the movie Night and Day and all four Shrek films on one disc. How much for the Shreks? 200 rubles, the guy in the shop says. Less than $7. Counterfeit DVDs like this are common, but Russia says the situation is improving.
The government is certainly doing much to stop the sales of illegal DVDs or trademarked products.
Vladimir Biryulin is the head of the legal department at Russian law firm Gorodisky & Partners. He says companies can get justice through the Russian courts on intellectual property violations.
If an IP owner, be it a copyright owner or a trademark owner, wants to stop the particular case of infringement, I can state that 99% he will have success.
U.S. manufacturers agree the situation has improved in Russia, but they say China's commitments regarding enforcement of patents and copyrights didn't materialize after it joined the WTO, and they don't want to make the same mistake again.
China is a factor because what we learned from the China experience is that we want to see action before we see accession.
Mark Esper is vice president of the Global Intellectual Property Center in Washington. He says Russia should be allowed to join the World Trade Organization, but not until it lives up to a 2006 deal on strengthening protections for intellectual property rights.
They were asked to enhance their criminal penalties with regard to piracy and counterfeiting. That hasn't happened. We've asked to strengthen border enforcement. That hasn't happened. So while it's fair to say they've made progress, it's also fair to say they haven't crossed the finish line yet either.
Now, President Obama has said he wants the negotiations on Russia's WTO bid wrapped up soon, but some observers warn that unless Russia does more to protect intellectual property rights, it may have to wait. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. Now it's time for today's Marketplace Globalist Quiz. Our global quizmaster, Stefan Richter, gives us a wider perspective on international news and trends. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Bill. So are you ready for today's quiz?
Yes, I am.
On average, how much does it cost to support one U.S. soldier deployed to Afghanistan per year? Is it $67,000 per year? $132,000 per year, $685,000, or $1.2 million per year?
It can't be $1 million per U.S. soldier per year. I'm going to lower that to $132,000 per soldier.
You are a man who is way behind his time.
Oh?
$132,000 paid for one troop at the peak of the Vietnam War in 1968.
So what's the right answer, Stefan? Is it really 1.2 million?
You got it right.
Wow.
It's staggering. 1.2 million per year. And realize that of that, about $58,000 per year is the total pay per troop. But, you know, the staggering items in terms of the cost are that there are estimates that it costs up to $350,000 a year per troop deployed just on fuel and spare parts. And if you saw the Washington Post recently, they had a story that each translator, they have a soccer tournament here in D.C. where they recruit Afghan-born translators who speak Dari or Pashto, and those guys make $250,000 a year, and the recruiting agencies get $265,000 a year per translator. You know, when war becomes such a for-profit business, I think it's dark news for us taxpayers.
Stunning. Stefan, thank you for the insight.
You're quite welcome.
Stefan Richter, publisher and editor-in-chief of The Globalist. You can learn more about the global economy, politics, and culture when you visit theglobalist.com. And finally, YouTube is now allowing longer videos, 15 minutes instead of 10. The Google-owned site originally imposed the 10-minute limit because longer videos tended to be copyrighted TV shows and movies uploaded illegally.
Well, YouTube says it has improved copyright filtering technology, so now you can post videos that devote more time to subjects that truly deserve it.
Whoa, that's a full rainbow. All the way. Double rainbow. Oh, my God. It's a double rainbow all the way.
Why can't that go on for 15 minutes? And by the way, in case you haven't seen this viral video, I recommend watching a hiker brought to his emotional knees by nature's profundity at marketplace.org.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Woo!
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
I'm excited for him. That's fantastic. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.